or write to the Retail Clerks International Association, Washington, D.C., 20036. Again, Don Doak.
Allied forces in Vietnam have begun observing a 24-hour ceasefire to mark the Lunar New Year. A U.S. military spokesman says all air, sea, and ground action is stopped, but that Allied troops will retaliate if attacked. He said, too, that ground and air reconnaissance continues. Before B-52 bombers were grounded for the ceasefire, they flew several missions hitting troop concentrations and gun positions around Saigon, where the enemy is believed getting ready for an attack on the South Vietnamese capital. The Viet Cong's seven-day ceasefire began yesterday, but U.S. officials say they have already violated it a dozen times or more. Shortly after it began, the enemy shot down two U.S. helicopters and badly damaged a third. Five Americans were killed, 18 wounded. Though little note is taken of it in the world, Red Chinese shore batteries continue to pound the nationalist Chinese island of Quemoy on odd days of the month. As a gesture of goodwill during the Tet holidays, Peking Radio says the Red Chinese Army has been ordered to cease fire on Quemoy on this Monday and Wednesday. At least five persons have been wounded in an attack on a government official's home in Dhaka, East Pakistan, as unrest continues to plague that country. An explosion early this morning blew out about 14 windows and set two small fires at the administration building on the campus at San Francisco State College in California. A security guard was slightly injured. It was the fifth explosion at San Francisco State since black students, supported by some whites and faculty members, began striking for school reforms last year. President Nixon and his family are expected to return to Washington tonight from a weekend stay at Camp David, the presidential retreat in the mountains of Maryland. Again, the hour's top story, more than 100 persons have been injured in Istanbul as rival demonstrators fought over the presence of U.S. Navy ships, which are winding up a week's visit to Turkey. This is Don Doak, NBC News, reporting.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you as a public service by radio station KNBR, San Francisco. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of KNBR in San Francisco for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by KNBR in San Francisco. We hope you enjoy today's story, and we welcome your comments. We'll get to our story in a moment.
Unfair housing isn't unfair, it's illegal. This is Herbie Mann. If anybody has refused to rent or sell you a house or apartment because you were black or yellow, Puerto Rican, Jewish, whatever, he is breaking the Fair Housing Law of 1968. What you can do is write to Fair Housing, Washington, D.C., zip code 20410. When the law says anybody can live anywhere, the law means anywhere. Unfair housing isn't unfair. It's illegal.
Now to our story. This San Francisco that we love and love to talk about has done more mad, outrageous, and fantastic things in its short span of life than an old world city of more wisdom and less charm would permit itself in 1,000 years. It is constantly doing the unexpected, the fantastic, the slightly mad thing. But of all its mad acts, none was madder or more lovable than its taking to its heart as its most beloved citizen, a madman. When we first told the story of Emperor Norton, we quoted that old saying, "All the world is a little mad, save you and me, and even you are a little mad at times." But Norton would not have approved of that quotation. The world called him mad, but he was too gentle, too kindly a man, and he loved mankind too much to call the rest of the world mad. There has probably never been a stranger eulogy of a madman than the ceremony in San Francisco just 35 years ago. For at that ceremony, the remains of Joshua Norton were removed to Woodlawn Memorial Park at Colma. The San Francisco Municipal Band played at the graveside. The Olympic Club Glee Club sang, and speeches and eulogies were spoken by such prominent San Franciscans as former Mayor Angelo Rossi, Ernest Woodsey, and William Penn Humphreys. The 159th Infantry of the Coast Guard fired a salute, and taps were sounded. Thus, San Francisco honored its beloved madman 54 years after his death. We're coming now to the story of Emperor Norton, but before we tell it, we want to plant one thought in your mind. Columbus said the world was round, and they called him mad. Benjamin Franklin said he could take electricity out of the air, and they called him mad. Robert Fulton said he could build a ship that could sail by steam, and they called him mad. And as you listen to the story of Joshua Norton, you will see the germ of greatness and vision and wisdom in everything he did. And yet, according to all reasonable diagnosis, he was mad. Joshua Norton came to San Francisco in 1849. His father had been an industrious Jewish merchant in London. But the son sailed away to make his fortune and by devious routes landed in the mining camp of San Francisco. He registered at the William Tell House and started out to see the city. A little place, a sprawling village along the waterfront, muddy, ramshackle, and hectic. But there was majesty in the hills that rose above the village and in the serene beauty of the bay that spilled at its feet. And Joshua Norton looked at it and said, "I shall stay here till I have seen this village grow to be one of the world's greatest and most beautiful cities." Men were rushing out of the village away to the hills and the gold mines to find their fortunes. But Joshua Norton said, "I'll find my fortune here, and someday the men will come back from the hills multiplied 1,000 times. And so he hung out his shingle, J.A. Norton, Merchant. And from the beginning, he was financially successful. He immediately won the respect of the San Francisco citizens. He purchased empty lots, sand lots, and lots that the high tides of the bay flooded. And he built stores and warehouses and sold them, and his fortune increased. Everything he touched seemed to turn to gold. And soon the city bankers looked to Norton for advice, for his judgment was considered infallible. He worked arduously to turn the village into a metropolis. Men of affairs called him into consultation before they embarked on new enterprises. Why, when a man was in doubt as to the value of an investment, friends would advise him to ask the opinion of Joshua Norton. San Franciscans called Norton a genius. "He's destined for great things," they said. "He has the potentialities of an empire builder, the qualities of an emperor." That was the word. Norton was an emperor. Yes, they used the word emperor freely, half in joke, half seriously. They would meet him on the street and grin and say, "How are you, Emperor?" And Joshua Norton would grin back and say, "Fine, making money as usual, but don't call me an emperor. This is a great country, and its strength is its democracy." Yes, he was a very wise man, was Joshua Norton. He knew the strength inherent in democracy. But still everyone grinned and called him emperor. In just 4 years' time, Joshua Norton had accumulated a modest fortune, some say more than $250,000. And then, with his wealth in hand, he embarked on a project to corner the rice market of the world. In good faith, he induced friends to invest their fortunes in the project. He had entree to all the banks, and the investors were easily found, and Norton's rice market was famous. Approximately $300,000 was poured into the market, and then the bubble exploded. the investors lost their investments, and Joshua Norton threw every dollar of his fortune into the pool to pay as many of the losses as possible until he was penniless. Oh, he continued to walk through the city streets, but now he walked tragically alone, for he was a pauper. And then he disappeared. For several months, San Francisco heard nothing of him, and San Franciscans said, "It's just as well. He was an emperor for a day, but, oh, he has no place now in the city of his past glories." We'll get back to our story in just a moment.
Several years ago, George Foreman was a high school dropout in Houston, Texas. He decided to give himself another chance and joined the Job Corps, where he earned his high school equivalency diploma. He also learned boxing, and after winning the AAU heavyweight crown, went on to win the Olympic gold medal at Mexico City. I asked George why he joined the Job Corps.
I joined the Job Corps because I felt I needed more education and I needed a skill. I was a high school dropout. I was hanging around on the corners looking for a job and had certain dreams, and I knew I couldn't get it that way, so the best thing happened. Someone created this program called Job Corps, and I found myself I had to be a part of something, so I guess that was it.
If you are 16 through 21, out of school and out of work, give yourself a chance. Inquire about the Job Corps at your state employment office or write to Job Corps, Washington, D.C.
Now, back to our story. One day, the man whom businessmen had called Emperor strode majestically down Montgomery Street. He wore a uniform that was a combination of the Army and Navy. He wore extremely high epaulets on his shoulders. He carried a narrow cane of grapevine, and he wore a high beaver hat with a brass clasp that held three brightly colored feathers. He strode to the office of the Bulletin, and he proclaimed himself Norton the First, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. It was in 1854 that Joshua Abraham Norton disappeared to reappear as Emperor Norton. And for 26 years, he was a familiar sight on the city streets. He was a grotesque comic opera figure of a man, a madman, full-bearded, sharp-eyed, wearing his absurd uniform and busy ruling his imaginary empire. He sent cablegrams to Victoria, Queen of England, and the Tsar of Russia, and the German Kaiser, telling them how to run their business. Science calls such men megalomaniacs today. But every undertaking of Norton in his empire of fantasy was constructive, an act of kindness, an act of friendliness, or for the good of mankind in general. Now, certainly to be a successful emperor, one had to have a royal exchequer, so Norton went to a friendly printer on Liedersdorf Street and ordered royal currency printed. And the printer, as a joke, ran off a mass of cash certificates of 10, 25, and 50 cent denominations. Now, the cash certificates, of course, were printed as a joke. But the emperor saw no humor in it, so he used them. Of Norton the First, Emperor of the United States. Well, we must qualify that statement. There was one occasion, and only one that we have been able to discover, when his royal currency was turned down. He was journeying to the state capitol at Sacramento to attend, as he regularly attended, the session of the legislature and to advise the legislators. The dining car waiter did not know the tradition of the emperor's currency and refused to honor it. And it was one of the few times in his mad life that Emperor Norton flew into a rage. He pounded the table and shouted for all to hear that he would revoke the railroad's franchise. The train conductor rushed in, recognized Emperor Norton, and apologized in the name of the Central Pacific Railroad and the Empire in general. And the next day, the Central Pacific sent Emperor Norton a pass, good on all of its trains and in all of its dining cars for life. His Imperial Palace was a lodging house on Commercial Street, and each night he paid 50 cents for his room. He refused to rent it by the week or the month, although he lived in it for 17 years. It is generally believed that the 50 cents was contributed regularly by the Occidental Lodge of Masons, of which he was a member. He was a man of deep religion. The precept of his Jewish faith was that there was only one God. So each Saturday morning he went to the Jewish synagogue and, seated in the balcony with his nondescript dogs, Bummer and Lazarus, he devoutly followed the ancient ritual. But because he knew that there was only one God, he reasoned that his God must serve all mankind and all faiths. And so each Sunday morning, accompanied by Bummer and Lazarus, he went to Mass at the Catholic Cathedral. Yes, Bummer and Lazarus went everywhere with him. No theatrical performance opened in San Francisco from 1855 to 1880 that three complimentary seats were not put aside in the first row balcony for Bummer and Lazarus and Norton I, Emperor of the United States. In Sacramento, a seat was reserved for him in the visitors' balcony of the Senate. He was an honored guest, and when on occasions he was permitted to take the floor, his remarks, although listened to with suppressed chuckles, were listened to nonetheless with respect, for there was wisdom in all of Norton's madness. He was a fervent opponent of woman suffrage. He almost broke up a meeting of the National Society by telling the lady speaker to go home and clean house and have children and leave lawmaking to the men who understood lawmaking. There was another meeting that Norton attended. Hoodlums and ruffians were making the life of the Chinese population of San Francisco miserable, and so a mass meeting of indignant citizens was called. During the speeches, the hoodlums commenced booing, and a fight started between two hoodlums, and others joined in until the meeting developed into a free-for-all. And at the very height of the fight, the funny little man in a blue and red uniform, wearing a beaver hat with gay feathers, mounted the platform and pounded with his grapevine cane. The rioters paused long enough to laugh at the absurd figure and then become quiet. For slowly, deliberately, in a quiet but compelling voice, Joshua Norton read the Lord's Prayer, and the meeting ended in solemn silence. A madman, yes. But as I have said, there was the strength of wisdom in all Norton's madness. For example, his chief obsession was the need of understanding between England and the United States if this civilization was to endure. So, to cement the friendship of the two nations, he sent a telegram to Abraham Lincoln ordering him to marry the widowed Victoria, Queen of England. The telegram was received, and in answer, the president's secretary promised that Mr. Lincoln would give careful consideration to the command. Oh, he sent telegrams to the German Kaiser and the Russian Tsar, telling them how to best manage their nations. And practical jokers sent Norton telegrams from the Tsar and the Kaiser, promising to obey his commands. Norton saved and cherished these spurious telegrams, and they were found among his effects after his death. But meanwhile, he faced a problem. His imperial uniform was wearing out. So the emperor appeared before the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and told them it was a disgrace that the city should permit its emperor to appear in such unseemly garb. And without a smile, the supervisors went into executive session and wrote into the city charter an act whereby Norton the First, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, would receive $30 a year as long as he lived to buy uniforms. And for a dozen years, Norton appeared each year before the board and collected $30 for a new uniform. Many of the stories of Norton are familiar and need no repeating. For instance, there was the day he won the scorn of a prominent banker by making the preposterous suggestion that a bridge be built between Oakland and San Francisco. Why, everyone knew that just could not be done. And of course, there were the days when each of his two beloved mongrels, Bummer and Lazarus, died, and thousands of San Franciscans followed them to their grave, where they were buried as wards of the city. And then there was the day that Norton evolved the fantastic idea that Christmas was a day for children, and that a public Christmas tree should be lighted in Union Square. A mad, crazy idea. But the city approved, and thus the first outdoor Christmas tree was lighted. On a January day in 1880, Joshua Norton was walking slowly along Kearney Street toward California. He was tired and he was lonely. His dogs were dead. Many of his friends were dead. Slowly he turned up California Street and paused in front of Old St. Mary's, where Sunday after Sunday he had attended services. He paused and stumbled and fell. And before a hack could speed him across the cobblestone city streets to the receiving hospital, he was dead. The city he loved went into mourning for the mad emperor. Flags flew at half-mast. 30,000 people followed the funeral cortege to the grave that had been dug for him in the family plot of the wealthy San Francisco pioneer, Joseph G. Eastland. And the funeral expenses were defrayed by Eastland's club, the Pacific Club, later to become the Pacific Union. That was in 1880. 54 years later, in 1934, members of the Pacific Union Club moved the mortal remains of Joshua Norton to Woodlawn Cemetery. The mayor spoke, and the municipal band played. A military salute was fired, and taps were sounded. And newcomers to the city said, "What a fantastic city! What a mad, outrageous city! All that fuss for a man who thought himself an emperor. A poor, crazy little man in a red and blue uniform with feathers in his hat."
This is Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen. I heard someone say the other day they felt patriotism was making a comeback. It is most regrettable to think patriotism has ever reached a point where it must make a comeback. I do know of one place where patriotism has always flourished. I'm thinking now of the National Guard. I'm thinking of times when the National Guard has made airdrops of food during a blizzard to help save a cattleman's livestock. I'm thinking of times the National Guard has helped to save lives in flooded areas. I'm thinking of the Air National Guard units that were called in just a matter of days for duty in Vietnam. Patriotism, I'm happy to say, it is indeed alive and living in the National Guard.
You have been the guest of station KNBR for the San Francisco story. All of us here at KNBR hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall bring you excerpts from a little book by Lola Montez. Many of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book, Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. This is Bud Heide speaking for KNBR in San Francisco.
KNBR, AM and FM, San Francisco. The California Division of Highways reports U.S. 50 is open with chains required 2 miles west of Kyburz to Myers. Interstate Route 80 is open with ice and snow on the pavement from Cisco to Farad Carry chains. The forecast for the Bay Area Fair this morning, increasing cloudiness, then occasional rain heavy at times beginning tonight and tomorrow.
Is coming again. Cheer up, you pilgrims, be joyful and sing. Jesus is coming again.
This is the voice of prophecy, a voice crying in the wilderness of these modern days.